It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Now, I've thought about this. Maybe you have too. Who or what could be living on other planets out there, or moons? Or what might our own lives look like on the moon or Mars? But so far, we've got no evidence of other life, no ability to live anywhere, as far as we know, except here on Earth. Our next guest says life on other planets may be possible. It just might not be the kind of life you and I are living today. In collaboration with NASA, scientists are studying early life and evolution here on Earth to answer the question, is life possible on other planets? What would it take to start it? And should we give it a nudge? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the early origins of life on Earth? If we had the opportunity to give the process a nudge somewhere else in our solar system, say, should we do it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Betul Kachar is an assistant professor of bacteriology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. At UW, she runs an astrobiology research lab studying early life and evolution. She's the director of MUSE, that's NASA's Metal Utilization and Selection Across Eons program based in Madison. Betul gave a TED talk about the possibility of life on other planets and the ethical dilemmas surrounding that. Betul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you said something that really crystallized my thinking in that TED talk. I thought it was interesting on what the line is between chemistry, which is everywhere in the universe, and biology, which so far we only know about here on Earth. How do we even figure out that dividing line?
That's a very good question. We are working on figuring out that divide. If you think about it, life is a form of chemistry. And I briefly mentioned this in my TED talk as well, that we all are, and by we, I mean all living organisms on Earth, are chemistries that have memory. We remember, we defy degradation, we exist, we survive, we perish, and we recycle. So the big question is, what's the division between chemistry and biology? We know that this happened on our planet at least once, billions of years ago. We are here to figure it out, and we want to understand how that happened.
What do we know about how that happened? What do we know about the key ingredients in that chemical recipe that allows that chemistry to develop memory, to start reproducing itself?
Well, I can tell you that we know a lot more than we did only even 20 years ago. We know the molecules that existed billions of years ago. We use today and the life around us today to predict or infer the past. We understand the environments that these molecules, these chemistries existed in billions of years ago. But of course, this is a very tricky job. We are trying to figure out what happened billions of years ago, and such occurrences left very little behind. So we have very little to work with to understand early environments and early life altogether, which makes it more fun.
Now, here's a question. Earth's been around for billions of years, 4+ billion years. Life came along in only some hundreds of millions of years, a short amount of time in that scale. So you could look at that and say, okay, that means life is pretty easy. We're going to find it all over the place in planets and moons around the universe. Or you could say, we haven't found it. Maybe there's something super special about Earth, and we're really rare, this life on Earth. Where do you fall on that?
These are great, great points. You would think that life is easy for emerging because Earth did it in less than a billion years, as you pointed out. I like to think of it as, when we think we are old, we should always remember that life is 4 billion years old. So we are not at all, even though we may feel like aging fast, especially these days. It's important to think about life's processes and life's early chemistries within the nuance of evolution. We are thinking about an evolving system when we are thinking about early chemistries. So the question is, of course, how did this happen on our planet, or whether it happened once? Definitely Earth is a better chemist than us, because we haven't quite yet figured this out in the laboratories. And by we, I mean the broader astrobiology and origin of life community. I think that at the end of the day, we come to a realization more and more that we got something quite special here on Earth, that this may be the only planet that this, quote, miracle have happened. Even more the reasons for us to understand the beginnings of life here.
We're talking to Betul Kachar, assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison. She studies the early origins of life here on Earth and what that tells us about whether or not we might find life on other planets. Betul, I am descended from, and you are descended from, and a fern plant and bacteria and whatever, all descended, it sounds like, from that earliest bit of life on Earth. Can we look at all of the genetics of us and somehow backtrack to figure out what those first ancestors would have looked like or been like?
That's exactly what I'm doing. And it's really exciting. So thank you for asking this. Think about that. All life on Earth shares a DNA molecule that we think existed also in our earliest ancestor. So we are walking heritage, a 4 billion year old. We carry this 4 billion year old heritage within us every day in everything that we do. And to make this very interesting, we share about 50% DNA with a banana, right? So this is very fascinating to me, and also shows how related we are. And yes, we are using a methodology in my lab to use this shared nuance within all life on this planet today to find out the common DNA sequences that existed billions of years ago, the ancient DNA that was present early on this planet. We also resurrect these ancient DNA that we computationally generate first. So we use mathematics and statistics to first figure it out, but then we resurrect these ancient DNA inside modern microbes and bacteria to figure out how they may have behaved billions of years ago.
All right, Betul, this sounds like a pretty big job already, trying to figure out our common ancestor, how it came somehow out of chemistry. On top of that, though, you're looking at not just Earth. You're trying to figure out what conditions there could be on other planets. I mean, why, on top of what you're already doing, what made you want to pursue, you know, the rest of the universe, too?
Exactly. I like to think of it as that this is the best job in the universe. I mean, think about it. I am a biologist in the only known place in the entire universe where you can be one. This is definitely a very special job. And Rob, I like to think that, you know, some people travel the world to understand life. And don't get me wrong, I love to travel the world as well. But on top of that, I like to think of it as time travelers as well. We come to the lab to travel back in time to figure things out. And yes, as you said, the ultimate goal is then to connect what we learn in the lab to the galactic, to universal scale of life as a potential phenomena in the entire universe. It's quite exciting to be an astrobiologist.
Now, I'm a science fiction guy, and there's all sorts of stories about, you know, terraforming other planets or moons, like making them like Earth. You're thinking about a different question, though, not can we replicate, can we bring Earth biology to another place, but can we nudge a planet, say, to have the conditions that Earth did to create its own life? Can you talk about that a little?
Exactly. So my TED talk was about why we need to cherish this miracle of life on Earth. And one potential thought experiment that I wanted to suggest was exactly what you mentioned. It really started with a big what if. What if we are the only place in the entire universe that life exists? This was really inspired by my interactions with the general public. Every time I give a public talk and ask a simple question, how many of you think that there might be life elsewhere in the universe? Almost the entire audience raises their hand. We seem to think that there is other life in the universe simply because perhaps there are a lot of planets and many different possibilities out there that we know more now. But what if that is not the case? What if this is the only planet that harbors life? So I wanted to take the audience to a journey with me, starting with this possibility, and then also connecting that with a possible discovery that we might be very close to, which is figuring out how life started here. So if we were the only planet with life, and if we figure out how life started here, what do we get to do with that knowledge? And it's exactly what you pointed out, that I wanted to ask the audience, should we spread chemistries that may potentially give or allow a planet, a distant planet perhaps, to give birth to life? And that is different than terraforming. That will be different than moving Earth-like life elsewhere.
We're talking to Betul Kachar, researcher with NASA and assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison, looking at the origins of life on Earth, the possibility of life on other planets, if we on Earth should help create the possibility of life on other planets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Betul asks her live audiences, do you think there is life out there on other planets, or do you think we're all alone? Raise your hand. And then use that hand to call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And when and if we have the capability, should we try to create Earth-like conditions on other planets? Or do you want to play one of my favorite games, Terraforming Mars, someday? Or do you like Betul's notion of creating the conditions for life and then seeing what happens? And if it comes out different than what we have here on Earth? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our conversation about the origins of life with Betul Kachar, looking at her research on early life on Earth and the potential for life elsewhere. With NASA, Betul is studying the missing piece that could allow life on other planets. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the origins of the earliest forms of life billions of years ago here on Earth? Do you have thoughts on whether we humans ought to try to create the conditions for life on other planets? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hey, friend. I totally believe that there's life on other planets, and I totally believe that whatever that life is, they are intentionally trying to avoid us. Because we fouled things up here so bad that they want us to just leave them alone. That's what I think.
Mark, thanks for the call. And Betul, this is a question you think about, given our track record here on Earth, do we have the right to potentially, as Mark says, mess things up on other planets?
That's a great point. And that's exactly the nuance that I was aiming to bring on the table, that we perhaps should not be messing with other planets and instead study them very carefully and understand their conditions. So sending whatever the chemistries we potentially, and again, let me remind everyone that this is a thought experiment,
right?
Would be about perhaps providing more of what that planet has, would not be about contaminating the other environment or this location with what we got here.
Thanks a lot for that call, Brian, at 800-642-1234. Betul, from our vantage on Earth and, you know, some satellites in orbit and a couple samplers on Mars and whatnot, like how easy would it be for us to tell if there was life on another planet?
This is a great question, Rob, because there's a lot of investment and effort right now in order to improve our telescopes that are allowing us to see further and further. We have the James Webb Telescope, and there's going to be really remarkable images coming from there. We are expecting these in years to come. And the research on exoplanets, these are the planets outside of our solar system, has never been this exciting. More and more, we are learning how to best predict the environments, what would the signatures that we are observing might mean. As we get better and higher resolution in our telescopes, we will be able to see further and beyond. So this is a great time to study these sort of space-related disciplines, I think, in colleges and universities, And UW-Madison also has a very strong foundation and future in origin of life in astrobiology and space biology in general.
Now, here's something I wonder about. You know, we're pretty good at recognizing forms of life as they evolved here on Earth. Is it possible that there might be life somewhere else that is different enough in some way that we might have trouble even recognizing it as a form of life?
That's entirely possible, but we are basing our understanding on what we got here to start. And I need to point out, and this also goes to Brian's point earlier, Earth is my favorite planet. We should not take life on Earth for granted. And perhaps realizing what happened here and understanding it thoroughly, and this goes to exploring what is out there as well, would motivate us better to protect our home. Planet Earth is our home. And definitely exploration and space exploration should and does start here.
We're talking to Betul Kachar from UW-Madison, looking at her research on early life and its evolution here on Earth and what it means for life possibly existing elsewhere. Still time for your calls with your questions or thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think we're alone out there? Do you think there's life on other planets? If there is not life on a planet, should we help it start? 800-642-1234 is the number. Betul, I wanted to ask you about this MUSE project with NASA. You're looking at metals and why some seem to be involved in the development of life, or this is part of your research, some seem to be involved in the development of life, others not so much. What are you looking at there?
Right. So I recently moved to Madison to establish a NASA Astrobiology Research Center as a part of my laboratory and research program at the Department of Bacteriology. Our goal is very clear. How can we expect to find anything else out there or to even understand or come close to understanding the universe if we do not understand what we have here? This is where we start. We lack a deep understanding, and forget about deep. We lack an understanding of our own life and our own life's history on this planet. And this is exactly what I'm going back to, that we should not take what we have around us for granted. I think most of the time when we think of space, we forget that we are in it. We are life in space ourselves. Yet we lack understanding of how things evolved and how environment and this planet itself led to this magnificent biology that we see around us today. So my center, MUSE, is a 5-year project. It's a multi-million-dollar, multi-institution nationwide. We're connecting multiple institutes project that looks into how does elements, in particular metals, factor into life as we know. Because the question is, we are looking for life as we know elsewhere, but can we look at the metals and elements elsewhere to predict whether life that we know or something like it will rise in these bodies.
Time for another caller. Jack is with us in Eagle River. Jack, hello.
Hello. I would like to know if we, I don't think we should be planting our life on another planet, but can we search for this type of chemistry that might be life and infuse either something like a fertilizer or an enzyme into it to assist it along?
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. And that brings us back to your big thought experiment, Betul. How much, what kind of nudging hypothetically could it take, say, at a place like Mars to help create the preconditions for life?
Thank you, Jack. Your question has two layers. At the one level, we do such experiments on Earth. We try to understand what would it take for a chemistry to transition into biology. Does it miss an enzyme, as you pointed out, or is it a certain element or a metal or a different, completely different environmental condition? So researchers are creating these sort of environments or I would say simulating these sort of ancient Earth conditions on Earth to understand this very transition. At the same time, we are now studying our own neighborhood, right? We study Venus, we study Mars, we definitely we will be going to Uranus, we were going to go to Uranus, and we will be going to different moons. So definitely there is a lot of knowledge coming from different planets and moons within our solar system, and will be. We understand their chemistries. However, we lack that very connection. It's almost like judging a book by its cover. We can look at them, we understand their chemistries to some degree, but we don't know why they don't have life.
All right, Beto, we just have a minute left, and I got to ask, suppose I somehow had this toolkit where 100% I drop this on a planet, it's going to create these preconditions for life. We're not going to drop any Earth bacteria or anything in there with it. If you had that capability, would you do it?
I knew you would ask me this. I honestly think that we may not have any other choice. If we figure out that we are the only forms of life in the universe, and if we end up destroying ourselves at the speed that we do, we may have to ask ourselves whether we should replicate or at least spread the miracle that we have here. It may come down to that. And I, for one, think and understand that life, even if we did something like this, it would take billions of years for anything to be born in wherever we are sending. So this would almost be backing up what we got in a more profound way than only perhaps planting some Earth-like seeds elsewhere. And by seed, I mean actual plant seeds, or terraforming different planets by sending them Earth microbes. This would be a little bit more deeper, nuanced than that. Can you tell I watched a lot of Star Trek?
Beto, I can. And thank you so much for sharing your research with us today.
Thank you so much for hosting me.
That's Betul Kachar, assistant professor of bacteriology at UW-Madison. She runs an astrobiology research lab there studying early life and evolution. Also does work with NASA on the origins of life. Coming up after the news, we talk to an extremism expert about the arson at an anti-abortion rights office in Madison and other politically motivated violence. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's caves might be the place to go if you're looking to beat the heat this summer. We'll talk to a caver about respectfully and safely exploring caves around the state. Now, law enforcement agencies in some states are preparing for potential civil unrest, maybe even violence, as a result of the leaked Supreme Court draft decision overturning Roe v. Wade. At the federal level, the Senate just passed a bill to give police protection to Supreme Court justices and their families. Over the weekend, an anti-abortion rights group's office in Madison was set on fire. In addition to the arson in Madison, there have been a couple acts of vandalism and attempted arson at other anti-abortion groups around the country. This comes after a long history of vandalism and violence targeting abortion providers, including a couple of mass shootings at clinics, a 2012 arson attack at an Appleton clinic, and a still unsolved arson attack at a Knoxville, Tennessee abortion provider last New Year's Eve. Our next guest is an expert on extremism and violence. He worries that our current political and social environment is a bunch of dry kindling waiting for a match. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to this arson incident at an anti-abortion rights group's office in Madison? What do you think motivates people to commit acts of political violence? What do you want to know about extremist ideology? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Brian Levin is the director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and a professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. Brian, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we turn to some of the wider issues, Brian, this particular incident in Madison, you know, there's been an online claim of responsibility from a as yet unknown group. Things just look kind of vague. No arrests or charges filed as of our speaking here now. What do you make of this event coming in the aftermath of the leak of the Supreme Court document?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell the connections of who did this stuff. But we've seen this in other states, as you'd mentioned, including Texas, for instance. In this particular instance, the language used, the reference to Jane's Revenge, which was a collective that actually you have an article on your website about from decades ago, and the use of intermediaries and Bellingcat to get the message out, signals to me that this is probably more than just a solo actor and someone who is part of some kind, and it could be a very small and even informal association of individuals who are looking to this as an inflection point. And understandably so. Wisconsin and the nation as a whole has been both relying on this as precedent for decades, and the majority, as I said, indicated by numerous polls, both in Wisconsin and nationally, do not want these kinds of restrictions on abortion.
Looking at a slightly longer view now, this has been a contentious issue since before Roe v. Wade was issued by the U.S. Supreme Court about 50 years ago. There has been violence, sometimes lethal, sometimes in the forms of vandalism and arson attacks. What have we seen over the last few decades when it comes to extremist violence and other acts related to the abortion debate?
Well, what we have seen from Eric Robert Rudolph's attack, for instance, in the mid-1990s, to attacks, a fatal one in Buffalo, New York as well. The group, the Army of God, which was this informal association. But here's the thing. What I think is so interesting is when generally, and I want to be careful here, but generally when there is a change in legal status of something that is very emotionally tied to people, whether it's what we've seen during COVID, for instance, or in this case, you will see people who feel when legal avenues are cut off that they will go extrajudicially. And since we're having such a sudden change, I worry about a couple of things. One, that this is a catalytic event. And one of the things our data has showed us is that spikes in intergroup conflict are lasting longer. There's more traction with it. And around conflictual election seasons where there are likely flips, we've also seen escalation in aggression and even violence. So what I think, though, what you can see here, look at what we've had in Wisconsin, for instance. During the social justice protests, we had the evolution of these civil guards. We now have this kind of thing that's been occurring for some time. Just bear with me. When we see an increase in conflictual rallies, conflictual public demonstrations, oftentimes one side will use some kind of aggression or even frequency as a way to rally the troops. So what I'm worried about is that when we see things like this, there will be a reverberative effect on the next group that would be the 2023 Proud Boys, whatever they may be, or the 2023 Oath Keepers. Particularly as we go into political seasons, some of the reverberations and side effects of legitimate issues of public debate and protest around it are those who will capitalize on it. And what I'm afraid is on the hard right side, we have people who want to be like shock troops to respond to any kind of aggression. And this is a kind of a first salvo that appears to be coming from the hard left.
Talking to Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino, looking at extremism, violence, and the abortion debate, and what might happen if Roe v. Wade is overturned. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What worries do you have? What do you think it'll take to keep an important debate civil from spilling over into forms of violence? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Christian is with us in Green Bay. Christian, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I think people being violent towards these things, it's to show, like, they're angry, and they really are angry, because this decision is going to have a major effect on their lives, and people use anger and violence, you know, to get what they want. And it has worked sometimes, and it's not the best method, but they do use it, and it's worked in cases. So I think people are going to continue to be violent. I don't think it's good to be violent, but it does work, and it gives them, it showcases what they're doing.
Christian, thanks a lot for that call. A lot there. I want to start with the Christian's concern that people may see violence as something that works to affect change on their behalf. Brian, what do we know about that?
Great question. First of all, Christian Science Monitor some years ago published some very interesting compilation of studies that showed that actually violence is less successful than nonviolence. But let me move on from that to the main point that your caller made, which I think was very interesting and an excellent one. And that is, in recent surveys, the new Roe era that we're in, we had a 20-year high in the number of Americans saying that violence was a legitimate way to resolve political disputes. But it was heavily tipped to the hard right, 30%. Whereas on the left, it was 10%. Now that we've seen some inflection points, what I can tell you is I think that this kind of conflict will escalate. But again, I think a really good analog would be 2020, the social justice protests. The social justice protests were overwhelmingly nonviolent. Yes, yes, there were some that weren't, but we also saw in June 2020, a record number of hate crimes against African Americans, and it seemed to correlate with this upsurge in social justice protests. So what I'm saying to you is, even when we have peaceful responses to visceral, highly charged events like the George Floyd lynching, or in this case, the Roe decision looking like it's going to be overturned, that will be an inflection point. And what we've seen with the data, whether it's aggression online or related type of hate crime, these spikes in intergroup tension and violence are getting more elongated. And we're also seeing them occur around political events. If we can, just real briefly, if we can just look at a proxy, just using hate crime as a proxy, we've seen, for instance, the worst day in 2019 was around impeachment. The worst month last decade was November 2016, and the worst day in over a decade was the day after elections. So what I'm saying to you is what we have is a very amorphous type of associations where people will get quite genuinely affected, and most of these people will do peaceful things. But there will be those that are trying to exploit it, and these manipulators may not even be partisans. We've seen this kind of interference come from places like Russia and other countries over recent years. And unfortunately, social media has been the sticky swap meet where people can develop an a la carte type of position. And there are those who would want to exploit that. And what I'm afraid of is as the attention escalates, we already have an infrastructure on the far right that is more likely to have firearms and to be organized in a certain way. Not saying that there may not be aggression on the hard left, but we have not seen a lot of it yet. What we've seen in Wisconsin and Texas, for instance, are a first salvo, and it might mean what we often see is when conflict escalates, it escalates on each side with one side predominating. And I think the predominant, we don't know yet. Let's put it that way. Let's see what happens. We're at an inflection point.
Thanks for the call, Christian. We're talking to Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino, talking about political and social factors that lead to extremism in the wake of the arson targeting a Wisconsin anti-abortion rights organization. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about this, the potential for risk of violent extremism, or do you see things in our society that says, hey, maybe we can disagree and argue, but keep it peaceful along the way? What do you want to see from leaders across the political spectrum? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about extremism in the wake of the leaked draft decision that would overturn Roe v. Wade. Brian Levin stays with us, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, your worries, your hopes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Pat is with us in Eagle River. Pat, hi.
Yeah, I have a question. More or less a question. The Black Lives Matter group this past summer had a protest all over the United States for various reasons. And almost every one of them didn't end, but had vandalism in them, where the stores were being ransacked, robbed, burnt, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damage, vandalism. Who bears responsibility for that? I mean, is it the Black people that bear responsibility for that, or is it the law enforcement agencies? Where does that come down?
Pat, thanks for the call. Brian, what do you think?
Well, first, let's get some facts straight. According with respect to insurance losses, well over $1 billion in damage. However, Princeton University, ACLED group, they found that about just under 95% were peaceful. Also, let's look at some of the leadership. Al Sharpton, Ben Crump, and the families of people who were killed in police custody at the Get Your Knee Off Our Necks rally, each speaker decried violence. Each speaker did not say that they were very resilient in saying that they did not regard reform as being anti-police. So if you actually listen to the leadership, that's what you get. But look, bottom line is, no matter what, June 2020, where we had a surge of mostly peaceful protests, according to Princeton University, over 94%, we also had the worst month for anti-Black hate crime since FBI data collection had started. It was also the worst month for anti-white, going back to 92 around the Rodney King police verdicts. So unfortunately, one of the things that we have to understand when we look at this in a merely partisan lens is when we see heightened levels of conflict, people in their own echo chamber, and a sudden change or something that is catalytic, and in this case, it's both, I think we can expect a certain increase in conflictual behaviors. The question is, are we going to have an infrastructure of people who are either extremists or in an extremist network that will go even further? And in the past, what we've seen, for instance, when we saw stories of Antifa and BLM having busloads and plane loads going to various communities completely fabricated, we saw a response by self-styled militias. We saw, for instance, Proud Boys and Oath Keepers be involved in numerous conflictual public demonstrations and occupations in the run-up to the insurrection. So unfortunately, we have an infrastructure on one side and a highly charged catalytic event on the other, and we are quite concerned. We don't want to see anybody hurt. But if one thing I can tell you, what's happened in Wisconsin seems to me to be a job by someone who is more than just a dilettante. In other words, that they really have an ideological frame for this. And my guess is they're in some kind of network, even an informal and possibly small one. Remember, the Democratic Party itself, look at the Washington Post, did a story saying, please, protesters, keep it peaceful. Because what happens, I think, for those who are very concerned about what's going on, is that don't let the focus be on conflict. Let it be on the right that is deprived.
Pat, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Given, I hope, Brian, that all of us agree that we'd like to see less violence rather than more. Are there proven things that, I don't know, political leaders can do and or say to help prevent that and to have people channel their energy into political means?
Yes, but first of all, it's a great point. We saw hate crimes against Muslims drop precipitously the day after and into the next year when President Bush talked about tolerance toward Muslims. Conversely, we saw hate crimes against Muslims go up when the Muslim ban proposal was presented. But here's the problem. We are so splintered and we are getting our information from so many places. And there is indeed a division industry. Look at what Tucker Carlson, the highest rated show in primetime cable news, is doing. So the problem is these printed circuits of stereotypes, which Dr. Williams from Cornell talked about, labels a constellation of people and groups as legitimate targets for aggression. And what I'm afraid of, conflictual political environment, when we have people who are manipulating this and aggression seems to be paying off politically, that has a reverberative effect. As I always like to say, extremism is a carnival mirror reflection of conflicts and debates that are going on in the mainstream. But what if that glass is cracked too? So yes, certainly civic leaders should speak out irrespective of what side they're on. But in an era that has foreign and domestic manipulation of social media, conspiracy theories, and systems that are set up where people are on different strata that eventually become funnels that can take people when they are highly charged and have them believe things and do behaviors that they wouldn't otherwise do, represents to me a time of both political, economic, and sociocultural stress that we're just going to have more people who will not only rub elbows, but will go down that funnel. And that's what I'm concerned about. We have infrastructures on both sides that can escalate things. But of course, what I'm very concerned about, on the one hand, what we've seen so far has not been directed against violence against people. On the Army of God and these other folks who were traditionally involved in going after abortion providers, they have crossed the transom. So what I'm saying is we have one side that has a systemic use of, for instance, violence and even militia-type organizing. Another side that now has just started, if this is genuine, using violence, but it's directed against property. The bottom line is, as opposed to casting blame, I'll just close with this. Violence, once that comes out of the toothpaste tube, does not go back in. And what I'm concerned about is folks like the Civil Guard. We saw what happened in Kenosha. Will take already existing conflictual events and escalate them while being armed. And we will also have enough fodder for memes and others to exploit any side all over the virtual world.
We just have a few moments left. A caller on the line, Brian, asking if this event in Madison should be considered domestic terrorism.
Yes.
Easy. All right.
It's not an opinion. Hold on. I'm going to get all kinds of mail on this. When you use violence, threat, or intimidation, particularly with the commission of a crime like arson, that is meant to influence a subgroup, that comes under the definition of domestic terrorism. It's not my definition. What you have to do is, let's pretend we don't know what that office did, but it was fire on for ideological reasons. That, you know, that comes under the definition of terrorism. There's an ideological component, there's criminal violence, and it's directed to intimidate a subgroup. That's what the vandalism itself said. You're not safe.
Brian, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Brian Levin, director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and professor of criminal justice at California State University in San Bernardino. We talked about factors that contribute to violent extremism, including what might happen in the aftermath of this draft ruling on Roe v. Wade. You can always weigh in with your thoughts and follow the latest news on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, the state's top infectious disease doctor joins the show for a look at the latest COVID updates. The good news about declining numbers over the last bunch of months, the risks from future variants of the virus, the status of vaccinations, and more, plus answers to your questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we asked you about your dogs and whether your dog's personality and behavior were what you expected based on its breed or mix thereof. A lot of you called. We heard from Berta also on Facebook, who has a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. Berta says the dog is 3 years old and he just loves me. Well, I don't know if that's characteristic of the breed, but that's fantastic, Berta. We got a lot of responses from our colleagues at Wisconsin Public Media. Here's a couple few more of them. Emily Burdett, producer for some show called Central Time, says, my family has a Chesapeake Bay retriever named Teddy, literally the love of my life, like 80% Chesapeake. And she says some yes and no on the matchup. Yes, not particularly excitable. Yes, strong-willed and stubborn, actually obsessed with water. No, not aggressive toward dogs. No, he loves barking, barks at rocks in the water when he's swimming. They don't play fetch with them. Linda Murphy from PBS Wisconsin says our black and silver miniature schnauzer's personality definitely lives up to his breed's characteristics. Vocal barker, great watchdog. Keep sharing your dog stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time.